Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, celebrating 20 years dedicated to advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we take a look at the most talked about new provision in the healthcare bill that passed the House last week, high-risk pools. Can they really drive down the price of your insurance by keeping people with the most expensive pre-existing conditions in their own plan? We'll look at how the system used to work in California. We'll also talk to the producers of a new documentary film airing on Valley PBS called Tapped Out. The multi-part series looks at the past and future of Valley agriculture and the vital resource that makes it all possible, water. We begin our show today, though, looking at a different sort of water problem. Last week, we launched a series called Contaminated, where our team explores the communities in the region affected by water that's unsafe to drink. In our first story, we visited a Fresno County community that can't afford to maintain the arsenic treatment plant the federal government helped fund 10 years ago. We continue today with a look at a Madera County community in the mountains, where residents have been exposed to a different hazardous material in water for decades. But as FM 89's Ezra David Romero and Carrie Klein report, they could have clean water by the end of the year.
When Steve and Debbie Acree moved to the city of Oakhurst 17 years ago, they were told the water may not be safe to drink. They weren't too worried until...
The first morning we get up, we make a cup of coffee. My husband puts creamer in it, and it actually curdled. We were like, oh my God, we gotta go buy water.
Since then, they've stocked up on $50 worth of bottled water every month. The water in Oakhurst has lots of problems, but plumber Rick Markley has given one of the biggest ones a nickname.
We call that vitamin U.
Because everyone takes it.
Well, yes, you don't have any choice, right?
Vitamin U, he means uranium. It's in the tap water here. Oakhurst is one of 300 California communities with drinking water issues revealed earlier this year by the state's new Human Right to Water portal. Uranium is a problem for many water districts in the valley, but it's a particular problem in mountain communities, many of which struggle with other contaminants as well.
Out of all the non-compliant water systems in the state, a handful in the Madera County foothills have tested the highest for uranium. But they've also got a solution right around the corner. But what exactly is uranium, and how did it get here?
Uranium is a metal on the periodic table, and it forms naturally in rocks. Mike Massey is an environmental scientist at CSU East Bay. He says uranium's probably a lot more abundant than you think.
It's common in the crust. You probably have uranium in the soil in your yard. And actually, it's even slightly more common in granite, like you find in California, in the Sierras.
In fact, uranium's about as abundant as another metal that's been in the news a lot, arsenic. They both leach into the groundwater through entirely natural processes.
So when you hear uranium, you may think nuclear bombs, or Homer Simpson fumbling with glowing green rods at the power plant. But the kind of uranium pestering the foothills is nothing that sinister.
Massey says that's because they're different isotopes, which means they have different masses and levels of radioactivity. Almost all the uranium out there is the isotope uranium-238.
Uranium-238 is not what they make bombs out of. Uranium-238 is what they throw away so that they can keep the 235 and make bombs out of that.
Uranium-238 is far less radioactive than its sister isotopes. So in Oakhurst, water officials say it's totally safe to shower and wash your clothes with the water. But drinking it over the long term is associated with cancer and organ failure.
Cleaning up uranium can be challenging and expensive. Kevin Berryhill is an engineer with the environmental consulting group Provo and Pritchard. He says with higher uranium levels, the best option is to spend a few $100 on a filter that fits under the sink.
And that's important. It needs to be an under-sink unit with reverse osmosis, because just a regular Brita, which is an activated carbon filter, will not necessarily take out any of the uranium.
But in Oakhurst, with thousands of residents depending on the water, providers are thinking bigger. They've turned to a water treatment plant that currently takes care of other contaminants.
So this is the site of our current iron manganese removal system.
That's Jim Foster, general manager of the Hillview Water Company, which provides water to most of Oakhurst and the surrounding area. At the moment, uranium in the town's source wells tests at almost three times what the state says is acceptable to drink.
Foster says they mix the contaminated water with clean water, so what reaches homes is far cleaner. Even still, it's out of compliance with state standards. According to Foster, that will all change in the near future when a new treatment plant is erected in this very spot. He slaps one of the tanks to check the water level.
All of this facility will be taken out. It'll be regraded and leveled, and a whole brand new treatment plant will be here.
The new plant will use a more involved filtration system to remove uranium, as well as arsenic, iron, and manganese from the water. Plus, Foster says whatever they take out will be recycled rather than being dumped in a toxic waste landfill.
It doesn't end up stored someplace to where you would have to worry about it leaking out or someone calling you, you know, in 50 years saying, well, there was a barrel marked with your company on it, and so you have to participate in the cleanup of it.
Foster says this state-funded treatment facility needs to be built within the next 2 years and will cost around $5 million. It'll serve around 4,000 people in Oakhurst. Planning is also underway for three other water treatment plants in smaller communities nearby.
Even though water rates will go up slightly to maintain the project, Cassie Chahan with the State Water Resources Control Board says once the treatment facility is running, it'll be a huge benefit for the town.
For the first time in, for most people ever, they will have water that meets all of the drinking water standards, which from a public health perspective is very encouraging.
The system will eventually extend to some private well owners as well as a high school.
Construction should begin in early June, and the uranium treatment portion could be up and running by the end of the year. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Ezra David Romero.
This is Valley Edition. California's Republican congressmen were crucial to getting the American Health Care Act passed through the House last week. One change to the bill was key in getting the support of at least one of those congressmen, additional money for something known as high-risk pools. However, as Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess reports, they aren't a new idea in healthcare, and in fact, they've been tried before right here in the Golden State.
Since the bill passed the House last week with just two votes to spare, every yes vote was crucial, including the votes of five Central California congressmen, Kevin McCarthy, Devin Nunes, David Valadao, Jeff Denham, and Tom McClintock. A day before the vote, Valadao said one element of the bill that he liked is the high-risk pools, which would be akin to a separate insurance market for sick people.
And so with the high-risk pools, what you do is you create a way for the insurance companies to find a way to hedge their costs, which is go to the government so they can subsidize those highest-cost patients, and so it's not being borne by the average rate payer or insurance holder.
In an amendment to the bill, Republicans set aside an additional $8 billion to the $130 billion already in the bill to support high-risk pools should states decide to create them and allow insurance companies to charge sick people higher premiums. That is something currently banned under the Affordable Care Act, often called Obamacare. The idea is that if someone has a pre-existing condition and gets charged higher premiums by insurers, they could go to the high-risk pool to find affordable insurance. The result, in theory, is that the remaining people in the individual market would, in general, be more healthy, allowing insurers to charge lower premiums. This has actually been tried before the ACA in several states, including right here in California.
You know, it wasn't a good experience for the state or for the people who were enrolled.
That's Deborah Kelch, who's now the executive director of the Insure the Uninsured Project. But back in the early 90s, she was a legislative analyst with the state when California set up a high-risk insurance pool. She says the bottom line is it just did not work. At its high point, it covered 22,000 people. However, more than 360,000 were estimated to have been eligible. Since everyone involved was sick, it cost way more than the state was willing to invest. As a result, the state capped what it would spend, so there were long waiting lists. And for people who did get in, benefits were very poor.
It just wasn't an efficient way to meet the needs of these folks. And when the money was tight, it meant waiting lists. And it meant people couldn't get the coverage that they needed.
She does not think the roughly $138 billion in the bill would be anywhere near enough to establish affordable and effective high-risk pools. And there are a lot of people in California who could be potentially impacted if insurers are once again allowed to charge sick people more. An analysis by the Kaiser Family Foundation found that about a quarter of non-elderly adults in California have a condition that left them uninsurable prior to the ACA. Kaiser researcher Cynthia Cox says that means that right now, about 5 million residents have a pre-existing condition.
At some point in our lives, all of us will develop a pre-existing condition, and it's just a matter of whether you're unlucky enough to have to buy your own insurance while you have one that, you know, that's when it really starts to matter.
Cox adds a caveat that not all pre-existing conditions are created equal, and some are less expensive than others and do not require a steep rate increase. For example, heart disease or diabetes is much more expensive than depression, which is treatable with relatively inexpensive drugs. But are the high-risk pools a popular idea with voters? Since the bill only recently passed, there's not much polling about it, says California State University Bakersfield political scientist Dr. Janine Krabill. However, she says we can infer from the general popularity of companies being banned from charging sick people more that it is unlikely repealing that will be a winner with voters. Still, Krabill says the repeal of Obamacare has been such a powerful political promise for years, Republicans basically pigeonholed themselves with no choice but to vote for something likely to be unpopular.
So now I think that you have some of these Republicans, particularly those very close to Donald Trump, like Kevin McCarthy, who also ran with this idea that we are going to repealing and replacing, that they have to do it now. They've committed so much of themselves to doing this that they absolutely have to.
The vote and other actions by President Donald Trump and the Republican majority could threaten their seats, Krabill says. It's an especially touchy vote for Congressman Valadao, who represents a district with a double-digit Democratic voter registration advantage. So far, he's not drawn an official challenger yet. But Congressman Devin Nunes has already drawn a Democratic challenger, and Congressman McCarthy is facing a primary challenge by a political newcomer who says the health care vote is the reason he's looking to unseat the House Majority Leader. Unlike Valadao, however, both McCarthy and Nunes represent districts with Republican registration and advantage. The bill has a long way to go, and the midterm election is still more than 18 months away. So it remains to be seen how much of a political price they'll pay for voting for an unpopular bill that has the potential to strip insurance from maybe hundreds of thousands of their voters. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
Of the 64,000 children in the foster care system in California, less than 3% are in the adoption phase. Capital Public Radio's Bob Moffat reports the system is undergoing changes this year that may help more kids find a stable home life.
Benaya Stoops and his little brother Salem live in El Dorado County. They hang out with the chickens, watch Super Y, and await the arrival of their parents' first foster child. Benaya is 7.
Do you hope it's a little brother or a little sister?
Sister.
How come?
Because I already have a brother.
Janae Stoops and her husband Ben thought they would have to spend tens of thousands of dollars overseas to adopt before they discovered a foster to adoption program costs only $145. 9 months of classes later, Ben says they are prepared for a foster child.
They've all lost something, whether it's a background, whether it's a history, whether it's more physical or verbal abuse that's been in their life, and anticipating that.
Group homes have been considered a source of trauma for many children. Homes have been used by county probation departments as landing spots for kids in the criminal justice system. One new law will do away with them. To stay open, the homes must become temporary medical treatment facilities. Janae says she hopes to adopt, even though, according to the UC Berkeley California Child Welfare Indicators Project, the number of children who are returned to their birth parents each year is about the same as the number adopted by foster families.
I'm more looking at it as I am going to be fostering some kids, and I will have the opportunity to possibly adopt one of them. So that helps me kind of keep, I think, a good mindset, so I'm not severely disappointed.
Jennifer Nordquist works for Lilliput Children's Services as a caseworker. It's a nonprofit that encourages its clients to set adoption as a goal. She visits each child once a week. Today, she's at Jay and Cece's house. They've been caring for an infant for about a month. Jennifer has a mental checklist of things that she's looking for depending on the child's age and background.
How much are they eating?
What are they eating? How are the parents sleeping with whatever sleep pattern the baby has?
Lilliput Family Services takes care of the court hearings and passes along status updates to the baby's biological family. Jay and Cece say it's difficult to feel like biological parents when they must strictly adhere to court orders and doctor's orders.
It can get really stressful because the child's not your own. You're just a guardian of the child. So there could be things that, you know, you would do with your own child or that you wouldn't worry so much about with your own child that you're nitpicky at and you're calling your social worker going, this is what happened. Is everything okay?
Also, the baby could be reunited with its parents at any time.
Our philosophy is we're going to give them and love them as much as we can for as long as we can.
New law says foster parents training can be used to qualify them when it's time to adopt. They no longer have to go through the process twice. Patience is a virtue for any parent. In Yolo County, it took Darren and Stacy Nixon 4 years to go from orientation to adopting Damien. He's delighted to show off his new home to visitors.
Yeah, I'll help you.
You'll help? Okay.
I'll give you a tour.
You're going to give me the tour?
Yeah.
All right, great. Where are we going?
Stacy says his adoption was pretty easy once they got to the process. She agrees with changes in the law that require biological family members to undergo the same training she did to be considered as a foster parent.
I think families should be vetted because sometimes families stick together even when it's not the best case scenario for the child.
The industry consensus remains that a foster child should be reunited with its parents if they can show they are fit to raise the child. But if that's not the case, the child should be kept in a single home and adopted out as soon as possible. In Sacramento, I'm Bob Moffitt. You're listening to Valley Edition. A drug and corruption investigation that has rocked Kern County law enforcement for the last 2 years has now grown into a new stage. Last week, two former Kern County Sheriff's deputies accepted plea deals with the U.S. attorney on charges they conspired to steal and then later sell marijuana, which the department had confiscated as evidence. Deputies Derek Penny and Logan August could face prison time for the offense, which follows last year's convictions of two Bakersfield police detectives for similar charges. Both officers Demasio Diaz and Patrick Mara, in that case, are now serving 5-year sentences in their respective trials. Joining us now to tell us more about this latest development is Lois Henry, columnist with the Bakersfield Californian. Lois, welcome.
Hi, Joe.
So last year, Demasio Diaz, when he was being sentenced, leveled these broad claims of corruption that extended far beyond just he and his co-conspirator, Patrick Mara. He said the Bakersfield Police Department had a culture of corruption. Now we find that this case involves the Sheriff's Department. Are these two things connected? What do we know right now?
Well, yes, they are connected. We do know that Penny and August, both in their plea deals, named Patrick Mara as their co-conspirator, as one of their co-conspirators, along with some nebulous others that are not named. And we also know that during last year's investigation, the DOJ and BPD both said that they were investigating at least 5 other officers in the BPD, one of whom resigned midstream. But that's all we know. They wouldn't say anything else about them other than when they finished their investigation that these guys were clean or they were not going to be charged criminally, and then they were going to just simply look at whether they had these other BPD officers had violated any internal policies. So, you know, it looks to me like there was that Diaz, thief and drug dealer that he was possibly being quite honest about saying that this was a widespread issue. And if you go back and you look at a 68-page statement that he filed with the court last year, in part of it he talks about the HDTA, the High Drug Traffic 3-County Task Force. I'm sure you know what I mean because we've all covered this task force that basically was looking for meth and trying to take down the big dealers without county jurisdiction being a problem. So we're talking about officers from a number of different counties and a number of different jurisdictions. And Diaz said that was basically unsupervised. They did buys, they confiscated drugs, they did all the things that you can think of as an undercover officer, and basically didn't really have anyone checking up on them. And that he called it basically rife for corruption. He acknowledged engaging in sales and corruption in that area. And of course, who knows how many other officers from which different jurisdictions there were. And then, you know, come to find out, two guys from the sheriff's department definitely named Mara in their plea agreements. So, it just makes you sort of drop your chin and go, okay, you know, what's next? And of course, all the law enforcement agencies are just, you know, playing mom. The sheriff's department won't even tell us if they've done any kind of an internal investigation, even just to, you know, revamp their procedures on their evidence lockers, or, you know, even bother to change the locks. I mean, they won't say anything to anybody. And, you know, it's sort of circling the wagons. And I think that that's the exact wrong thing. That's what my column was about. It's the exact wrong thing to do, because these things are happening in the public. These people are getting arrested and charged and possibly put into prison. So it's not like we don't see it happening in front of us. And we kind of like our law enforcement to at least crack the door a little and let us know what they're doing to try and ameliorate the situation.
Now, you can read Lois's latest column in the Bakersfield Californian and online at bakersfield.com. Lois, last year, then Bakersfield Police Chief Greg Williamson, shortly before he retired, said he didn't believe there was a culture of corruption in his department, and that the Diaz and Mara situation was an isolated incident. What do we know about that right now? Is there any additional evidence that there might be ongoing investigations there? You mentioned that those internal investigations, have those completed at this point?
We don't know. They won't say. And it's all because, you know, the police officer's Bill of Rights prevents any public scrutiny of individual officers or allegations of complaints and how those complaints were handled or whether they were found to be valid. The police officer's Bill of Rights, which I understand, you know, police officers are in a very sensitive situation. You don't want personal information about them leaking out to the bad guys. You don't want them to be in a constant state of fear of doing their job because people don't like the way they do their job and launching all of these allegations against them, although that stuff happens anyway. So I understand why there's a peace officer Bill of Rights. I don't think it should be thrown out. You know, it shouldn't throw out the baby with the bathwater. But the bathwater needs to be changed. The peace officer's Bill of Rights is what's keeping a lot of this stuff from public scrutiny. And so I have advocated in previous columns that it needs to be changed. And I think that we're just seeing yet more evidence that it needs to be changed.
When it comes to Sheriff Youngblood, you mentioned the sheriff's department has been quiet. He's been in the media quite a lot lately talking about his effort to make the county a non-sanctuary jurisdiction. Any word from Sheriff Youngblood on this?
No. And we specifically called the sheriff's department to try and get any kind of comments. And they were just like, nope, can't say anything. Nope. And they try and hide behind, you know, oh, well, the case isn't over yet because it's just a plea deal. These guys haven't gone to court to get their sentence and see what it is. And it's kind of all just, you know, bogus, if you ask me. There's a lot that they can say without damaging the case, and they could, you know, do a lot more to reassure the public. But, you know, frankly, in this county, I mean, you can see by my social media that I'm getting flayed for, you know, having the temerity to suggest that people with badges and guns ought to be held to account, you know? And so I think the sheriff's office really kind of rides on that protection, that buffer of actually having to answer any questions. I think to his credit, new police chief Lyle Martin has been a lot more open as much as he possibly can. But again, the police officer's Bill of Rights prevents him from being able to say a lot of stuff about things that have been happening, like the two officers who rousted the young black guys who were college students walking home from sort of a late night, you know, Taco Bell feed. And these gang officers just stopped them and ultimately ended up, you know, sort of getting into fisticuffs with them. And I mean, it was just terrible. And it's like, well, we want to know more about what happened there and why. Well, you know, Lyle Martin can't tell us because the Peace Officer's Bill of Rights.
Do we know if these two former Kern County Sheriff's deputies, if they are cooperating and perhaps might have other information to share with prosecutors?
Well, that may all have happened, but we don't get to know about it. The DOJ wouldn't even let us know what the initial charges were that were then pled down, which, again, it's all part of the plea. It's just nothing but protecting these guys. And frankly, the Damasio Diaz statement didn't really single out any individuals. He just sort of talked about widespread corruption and areas where there was corruption and that there was drinking on the job and, you know, more patrol officers might have been given money to help facilitate stopping bad guys and getting their drugs. And then, you know, Damasio and Patrick Mara would take those drugs. But they didn't say which patrol officers. At least it wasn't ever, you know, mentioned in the public statement. And as far as Penny and Logan, it's just been a complete, like, out of just left field. Like, what? All of a sudden these guys, you know, there's no indication that they were investigating them, no indication that they were even in plea deal talks. Then, boom, these plea agreements show up actually online through the federal court system, and, you know, media found them. And unless you ask DOJ a specific question, they're not saying anything. Meanwhile, as I point out in my column, you know, a Mexican national grows some pot in the national forest, and they're just like all about the press releases. So no, we don't know if Logan and Penny have been cooperating, or what that cooperation may mean, or what the initial charges were, because, of course, you know, you usually go from a big giant bunch of charges down to whatever your lawyer can get it cut down to. So the public, who gave these guys badges and guns, gave them $80,000 a year base pay and, you know, pensions that you and I could only, you know, hope for. The public who fronts the bill for that, the public that has to trust in these guys, the public that, you know, watches from the sort of back of the tailgate, we don't get to know anything. And I'm just really tired of it. You know, I mean, when Diaz and Mara were sentenced, I mean, the prosecutor went and shook their hands, and the judge, Lawrence O'Neill, you know, sort of cried about, oh, I wish I could pay for your education, to Diaz's daughter when she was giving, you know, her statement about her impact statement to the court. I mean, what? None of this would be. These are drug traffickers. These are, you know, these, and they're worse than drug traffickers because they put their fellow officers at risk. You know, they put their own families at risk to get a little bit more money when they were getting a damn good salary to start with. So I don't understand the kid gloves. I don't understand the support for these guys. I mean, they are just thieves and drug dealers, and everybody's sort of like, you know, oh, well, you know, we better be on, you know, give them the velvet glove treatment. And I'm like, I don't get it. I don't understand it. So if I was a cop, or if I was a cop's wife, I'd want to wring their necks. Oh, my God. They're putting their fellow officers at complete risk. Sorry.
These are federal charges that are being levied right now. There's also a state investigation into law enforcement in Kern County. Does this factor into that in any way?
Well, I did some PRAs, public records requests, to the California Attorney General, and I got, you know, sort of the pound sand kind of response when I was trying to find out exactly what they were looking at and who they were looking at and you know, how far this look extended. And so far, from what we've been able to ascertain, they're looking at more the civil rights violations of wrongful deaths and abuses, physical abuses and stuff like that. I don't know that they're looking into the, you know, law enforcement drug cartels that are apparently operating here in Kern County. So I don't know if they're looking into that or not. I mean, yet again, the public doesn't get to know. And I understand you can't, you know, open up investigations completely, but, you know, just a little bit, you know, something so that the public can know what's happening with their police forces, their money, their trust in these law enforcement folks. All right.
Well, it's very interesting.
You can tell I'm a little irked.
We will continue to follow this, as will Lois Henry with the Californian. The next court date is set for May 15th at the U.S. Court in Fresno, and we'll bring you updates on that and more. Again, Lois Henry with the Bakersfield Californian. Thanks so much for joining us.
All right. Thanks, Joe.
And stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment on Valley Edition and learn more about a new multi-part documentary out on Valley PBS. It's called Tapped Out. It's about agriculture and water here in the Valley. That and more coming up in the next part of our show here on Valley Public Radio. You're listening to Valley Edition. As tensions between the U.S. and North Korea ramp up, one Valley congressman recently returned from a trip to the Korean Peninsula. Hanford Republican David Valadao spoke with FM 89's Jeffrey Hess last week about why he made the trip and what he learned there.
We're speaking with Congressman David Valadao of Hanford. He represents California's 21st Congressional District. Thank you for your time today.
No, happy to be here.
You recently returned from a trip to South Korea and Japan. First of all, what was the purpose of going over there?
Well, I sit on the Appropriations Committee, and one of my subcommittees is the Military Construction Veterans Affairs Committee. And the fact that we have about 50,000 troops in Japan and just under 30,000 in South Korea, there's obviously base construction. There's construction of a lot of different facilities that have to do with our military forces there. And so that was the main purpose of the trip.
As I'm sure you're aware, tensions have been quite high between the U.S. and North Korea at this point. What I'm very interested in is what's the feeling like on the ground in South Korea?
So I actually spent some time in Seoul, and from Seoul we kind of based different directions to see the different bases on in the country. We went up to the border. At the border, you can tell things were a little more tense with those who were actually there working on the border, and that would go for both South Korean and the American military force I met with. But throughout the community, in the evenings or in the daytimes at the hotel, I never felt like anybody was acting nervous at all. I felt everybody was pretty comfortable living their everyday lives. And I don't know if it's just because they've lived like this for the last 50 or 60 years, but I did not see something that really stood out to me on as far as tensions among the regular folks living everyday life.
Because that's a kind of a feeling I don't think most Americans can identify with. We don't live with an aggressive antagonist immediately adjacent to us.
No, we don't. And there were a few, there was things that you would notice, like when you're driving on the freeway as we headed up towards the DMZ, the demilitarized zone. There were structures above the freeway every so often that were prepared to basically blow the legs out with explosives and allow those barriers to fall down and block roads in case of an invasion. So you know that they're preparing for it. You can tell that there's a lot of structures and even things put in place to protect from some sort of invasion. But aside from those being there, I didn't get the feeling that people were changing their everyday lives over it.
You went as part of the Appropriations Committee, seeing what kind of resources the bases would need in the event of an interaction with North Korea of any sort. Are they well-equipped right now? Do they have what they need?
Yeah, I do believe we have a lot of resources there. I do believe we have the ability to defend what we need to defend, or at least help in a fight. But the majority of the defense of the country is still South Korea's responsibility and Japan's responsibility. As far as the amount of troops we have there, well, I guess a lot of people don't really understand this. Of all the troops stationed there in South Korea who are part of this force, the U.S. only represents about 5% of those troops.
And I know a lot of the focus is on North Korea's nuclear weapons activity, but the proximity of South Korea and Japan, they could still do a lot of damage, including to U.S. troops with conventional weapons, right?
Yeah, they do have the ability to do some damage. I mean, they've got, well, I think, the seventh largest military in the world. Obviously, they have a lot of weapons. There are mountain ranges, so it's difficult for us to actually see what they have hidden behind some of their mountain ranges, but there's a lot of talk of some of the weapons that they have the ability to use. And so that does play a role in the decision-making process, and that's why the U.S. is helping with things like putting the THAAD system there on the border for high-altitude defense. It basically is anti-missile defense tools. So there are things that are being done, but yeah, there's no perfect world, and the best scenario would be to not have some sort of conflict start.
A lot of people, including here in the Valley, are questioning America's foreign military involvement. Do you think it's still in our interest to be so deeply involved with South Korea?
Well, like I said, we have people there, but we represent a very small part of it. I think on a world stage, helping to deter away from another nuclear power, especially someone who literally has almost no friends left in the world and runs, I mean, when they murder their own to keep himself in power, it's just not a free society. I think there is a place for the U.S. to play a role in this, to try to stop the spread of that type of dictatorship, and obviously a country like that having any sort of power. But I don't believe the U.S. should be a police force for the nation. But that's why I think that Secretary Tillerson is doing the right thing in reaching out to China and trying to get them to play an active role in it, trying to get them to put some pressure on the North Koreans to back away from any more of this type of rhetoric or back away from what they're trying to do with nuclear weapons.
Congressman David Valadao represents California's 21st Congressional District. He comes from Hanford. We thank you very much for your time.
All right, thank you.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. There's a new multi-part documentary out on California's agriculture community and its existential battles over water. It debuted last week with its first episode, and another one is coming this Thursday on Valley PBS. Filmmaker Jeff Aiello joins us, as well as Elizabeth Laval with Valley PBS. Elizabeth, I want to start with you. It's always interesting to hear where a project comes from and its origins in that case. How long has this project been in the works?
Well, Joe, as you can imagine, any kind of project that has to do with water in the Central Valley has to go through a lot of iterations to get to the right format. So about almost 3 years ago, we were sitting down trying to figure out how could we tell this story in a way that would not only say what people are hearing in news bites now, but how we got to now. And that would, of course, require that we went back and looked at the history and all the battles that have gone on, not just in the last 10 years or even 20 years, but over the last century. So then it evolved into a multi-part documentary, and it started and stopped a few times. You know, when we were in drought, it was a very different story than it is today that you see here on Valley PBS.
How much did TapTap change this because of that, with the massive rain that we had this year?
90% of the show changed. It was much more, because we really only had footage being on television. You have to show something. Well, we had the historical photos. We have all of that sort of thing. But honestly, the footage was dry, because every year since we had started the project, we had gotten no water. And so I would say that about 90% of the footage was reshot in the last year.
I want to bring in filmmaker Jeff Aiello now into the conversation. Jeff, how did you get involved in this project?
Well, I started working with Valley PBS at the beginning of the year, doing a series called Outside with Greg Aiello, who's my brother, and it's a new travel adventure travel show. So I was up and working with them on that. And then right after the beginning of the year, when it was clear that the drought had changed, and now here we are with the most epic rainfall we've had on record. And so PBS came to me and they said, hey, would you help us kind of redo this? We have to repackage it. We kind of have to redo it because the narrative has changed, because we have all this water now. And I loved the topic. I've always wanted to kind of dive into a big, meaty, heavy topic like this. And I did. And the more I went down the rabbit hole, the more I loved it.
So there's so many different ways you can go with an issue as broad as water in California. How did you come to this particular avenue? Did you intend to essentially tell agriculture's story? Is that the thesis of this project? What's the overall theme here?
Well, first of all, Jeff can speak to the content a little bit more, but honestly, you know, PBS has requirements, just as you do here at NPR. And it's our mission always to tell both sides of the story. This is not just some rhetoric that's in our handbook. It's really the way we handle projects. So all of our local projects are based on the fact that we're going to talk to all sides as possible, as much as possible. There's always somebody else. But we're really going to gather information from all avenues, present it to the viewers in a way that lets them make informed decisions. And so Jeff's mandate was, make it fair, make it right, let the viewers decide for themselves. However it comes out, if the facts tend to speak for themselves in one direction over another, that is just, it's without any color. No one in the funding side or anyone else has had any input into what the content's about.
And there's a lot of big moving parts with water. And before I really dove into it, I decided, you know, if we're going to do a 3-hour, first of all, the ability, the opportunity to do 3 hours of television to tell this is great from a filmmaker standpoint, because you get to be patient with the storytelling and really dive in and give time to the topics as they need it. I also didn't want to be too, I didn't want to go too deep and lose viewers. So I wanted to just keep it to the big moving parts and explain the two major water projects that make up the state of California, the CVP, the Central Valley Project for Ag, and the State Water Project for people. And so we did history, we explained the two projects, and then we broke it down into the next layer we broke it down into was the environmental revolution of the 70s and the passage of the Endangered Species Act in 70. That changed dramatically those two pieces of infrastructure and how they're used. That story has to be told. The third episode will get into more of solutions. How do we figure this out all together? How do we work together? Because right now, we're not working together in a state. We're not. And ag's feeling a tremendous squeeze from environmental regulations. They are. That's a fact. And so ag has to do a better job of communicating its message. And I think this film helps in that. This film is not an agent of theirs, but it helps get a story out that hasn't been widely, you know, displayed in the mainstream media in California, let's say.
This is one of the most polarized issues in California. Do you see anywhere in talking with the people that you did talk to that there is common ground or any signs of light there that maybe there might be some way to bring people together?
I think what it comes down to, so I think you're going to always have, just like with any politically charged battle, you're going to have the fringes on either side are going to be pretty dead set. They're not going to move, right? So in California, your primary voter base is in the population centers in the state, which tend to go left or liberal. And I think there's a lot of people in that segment, if they were to understand and know the true story of what's happening in the Central Valley to the Central Valley grower and agriculture in general, they might be swayed to change or consider looking at issues, regulations, and future laws in a different way. And I think that's where the possibility is for some sort of common ground. You know, right now the state has two, as I said before, two water systems. So it has two straws in a cup, right? It has a straw for ag and it has a straw for people. That's the State Water Project and the Central Valley Project. After the 70s and into the 80s, 90s, and now, a third straw, the environment, has been placed in that cup, right? But the cup was only built for two straws. So that's where the stress point is. So we've got to figure out how does that stress point, how is it relieved? And that's going to happen with, I think, when people start to understand that, as I just described in a simple way, that story.
We're talking with filmmaker Jeff Aiello as well as Elizabeth Laval with Valley PBS about this new documentary, and a multi-part documentary, I should say. It's called Tapped Out, The History and Battle Over Water in the San Joaquin Valley. It's on Valley PBS. It debuted last Thursday night, but if you didn't catch it last Thursday night, you can actually see episode one this Thursday night. Explain how what's coming up this Thursday night, Elizabeth.
Exactly. At 7 o'clock, we'll re-air episode one into the new episode two. And so every Thursday for the rest of May, we'll be doing that. The following week, you'll see re-air of episode two into three, and the following week, three into four. And also Sundays at 1 p.m., you'll catch that week's episode as well. Besides that, after the episodes run, the second time, we'll be putting it up on our website.
Great opportunity to check it out there. One of the things that's really remarkable about this is just the cinematography. I mean, you have some great shots. Tell me about that. You had also great conditions this year with all this rain to get some incredible photography. Tell us about that.
So when we set out to shoot this, and we knew we had to reshoot a lot of it because we had so much water footage, I thought and felt that, excuse me, I thought and felt that utilizing drones would be a great way to do this, because one of the things I wanted to do at the very beginning was I wanted to make the environment itself one of the cast members of the documentary. We were going to have plenty of talking heads, right? We're going to have plenty of people with their views and opinions on both sides, which we do. But the one cast member that's very important that doesn't get a voice is the land, right, and the water. And so we set out to sort of film that in such a way that it kind of brings it to life as much as you can, using, I think, powerful musical cues, and then just really covering all over the valley shooting a lot of drone footage, and it kind of helps that narrative as you're hearing these talking heads and you're hearing these good points. And there's great points on both sides of this, by the way, throughout the film, especially in episode two coming up. Episode two coming up has a lot of great counterpoints that you might have saw in episode one from the environmental side, which are very compelling. But that's the cinematography. We really put a lot into that and deployed some brand new drone technology to do it.
How much has that changed your line of work?
Oh, it's a lot. If you were to do this project, you know, 10 or 15, 20 years ago, shooting as much aerial as we did wouldn't have been possible with budgets, you know, if we were shooting with helicopters. So the fact that we can shoot that same kind of quality and in some cases better quality with drones now, for a drone that costs $4,000 with a nice camera on it, it's pretty impressive.
We have a couple clips from the show. Let's go ahead and play the first one we have here. Jeff, what is this one that we're about to hear?
One of the people we interviewed, David Sayers, is a PhD in hydrology and geology, a Fresno County citrus grower, and an environmentalist.
Wow.
All in one.
Trifecta.
Oh, man, I'm telling you. From a television producer standpoint, he was gold. And so I loved this guy. He's featured prominently at the beginning and end of episode one and two. And I think what we're going to play is sort of the opening monologue to episode two.
Let's listen.
What, on an instantaneous basis, is sort of necessary to keep you alive? What are those things? Well, the first one is oxygen, the second one is water, and the third one is food. Now, if you look at oxygen, how much do you pay for oxygen? You don't. You just breathe it in. What about water? What is water worth? What does it cost? Well, if you're in a municipal area, it probably costs you somewhere on the order of about a tenth of a cent a gallon. And that's water that you can drink right now and not get sick, which is an amazing thing.
And that goes on and in the actual documentary that we'll hear again Thursday night on Valley PBS. How do you find somebody like that?
Well, it was interesting. I went to the Public Policy Institute of California. They did a forum or a workshop here in Clovis, the PPIC, and they do a lot of good study work trying to figure out a way to get to some scientific solutions to these problems for water in California. I went to Elizabeth and I both went to the meeting here in Clovis, and I thought it would be a great way to use that forum as an audition room. So I just sat back with my notepad and watched people come up and talk, or people take questions, or people that were panelists. And then after they were done speaking, I would approach him. He's one of the people that I saw there.
There's a lot of experts on an issue like this, and just as talking about this from our perspective and being in media as well, a lot of them may be very knowledgeable, but are also maybe a little dry or a little wonky. Was that a challenge to try to get people who can explain something succinctly and in real language?
Yeah, I mean, I tried. Another design element of the film was to not go to politicians. So we do have one politician in that would David Rogers, and to be fair, I didn't invite him. he jumped and he did great. David, if you're listening, you were great. But he kind of jumped in the car with somebody else, and then when he was there, I said, "Yeah, let's shoot you." And then he had some great stuff to say. But by design, I wanted to stay away from that. I wanted this to have boots on the ground people that are dealing with, you know, that are fighting for the environment on that side, and that are, you know, the growers and the ag guys that are, you know, trying to grow the food we eat. And so I was pretty meticulous about who I selected based on that. I didn't run into any problems, really. Everybody I chose was really strong.
Let's go ahead now and listen to the second clip. Who is this?
I think we're going to be hearing from Eric Wilson, who started My Job Depends on Ag, the very popular Valley Facebook page.
Let's listen.
You know, in the big scope of things, you're not talking about a big area producing that much food for a country. And the reason is the soil and the climate, and until lately, our infrastructure. We're allowed to use it. And we've been able to feed this country. And the crops that are going to disappear first, they're not some exotic foods that a minority eats. It's fruits and vegetables and nuts. It's a very important part of the American diet.
Los Angeles, you get your water from the same pumps we do.
in the same locations. If they're not running, you're going to have to pay a fine if your city doesn't reduce its water consumption by 25%. And the water was physically there, people. It was physically there. It could be put in and parked and saved for you and for me, but it's not.
And turning now to Elizabeth Laval, the series that you're doing is three parts of a produced documentary, but there's also a fourth part. Tell me about that, because it actually happened, or at least was produced last night.
It was. So when Jeff produced the documentary, of course, we wanted it to be something that could be utilized, you know, as you do. We want them to be educational. And we didn't get into everything that's happening right now. We wanted the documentary to raise more questions than it answered. And so we conducted a panel last night. It was taped last night to air in that fourth episode slot on May the 25th. And we had experts and a moderator and let folks just basically have a conversation. You'll note that it's called Tapped Out, a Conversation. It wasn't a question and answer session as much as it was kind of a dialogue across the room of differing points of view. And we hope that we can do that in the future, maybe in 6 months or a year, come back and see, well, what has progressed? What's different? What's better? And really, a lot of the focus started on storage. They talked about storage quite a bit. And strangely, you'll find that there are viewpoints that you wouldn't expect out of the people that were on the panel.
We've got about a minute left. Again, tell us where people can find this and how the series runs out.
So Valley PBS, over the air or on Comcast or DirecTV, any way you find it, we are airing on Thursdays. The first run episode airs at 8. The previous week's episode airs at 7. It also runs on Sunday at 1. But after the week of the episode, you'll be able to find all of it on valleypbs.org/tappedout forever.
Well, we certainly look forward to it, and great job. It looks like a beautiful finished product. Again, Elizabeth Laval and Jeff Aiello, filmmaker behind Tapped Out, the history and battle over water in the San Joaquin Valley. Thanks so much for both of you joining us today.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to know what you think. Send us an email, talk@kvpr.org, or tweet us @kvpr and @Valley Edition. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Carrie Klein and Jeffrey Hess, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, celebrating 20 years dedicated to advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. chcf.org.